This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio, Hawaii Talks. I'm Catherine Cruz. The Honolulu City Council has approved one of the strictest plastic bans in the country. It closes loopholes on our plastic bag ban and bans plastic food utensils and styrofoam containers. The council voted 7-2 following 2 hours of in-person testimony before the full council, and that's not including thousands of pages of testimony, celebrity endorsements on social media, and national attention on the bill. Bill 40 now goes to Mayor Kirk Caldwell for review, and if signed into law, the plastic ban would be phased in January 1st, 2021, with the full rollout starting in 2022. Councilman Joey Monahan introduced the original bill, and while environmentalists championed the bill, businesses said the bill's language was vague and could ban favorite local foods from supermarket shelves, like plastic wrap spam musubis, jars of kimchi, and takeout bentos. The final floor draft of the bill addressed these issues, but there were still concerns. Ari Potts, the original sales and marketing manager for Sustainable Island Products, was in support of the bill. And during his testimony, he brought several alternate food products, such as biodegradable utensils, paper straws, and compostable clamshells.
The product list goes on and on. These products are here. I've been representing these products in this state for over 10 years, and not a single client has gone out of business switching to these products. In fact, some clients have opened their doors beginning with the use of these products. These products work, they are available, and they are affordable.
And Joy Gold of K. Yamada Distributors, which sells food container products to restaurants and food businesses, opposed the bill. The company sells plastic containers as well as alternatives. She expressed some concern about a recent PLA shortage, which is the bioplastic used to make sustainable products.
You've heard from two representatives from distributors of compostable products saying that there is no shortage, plenty of material to distribute. KYD is also a distributor of alternative products. And in our testimony, we offer you the experience that KYD is going through with its customers. And I really think fact-finding is needed about what happens. Do we actually have a shortage? Will it increase as this ban goes through? And contrary to what was said, World Centric gave alert on August 5th, 2019, of the PLA shortage and increased costs because demand exceeds supply. So short shipping is an issue right now. Oahu cannot compete because our market is so small. So what happens when restaurants, when consumers do not have the acceptable products? That is something that's going to be an issue.
And Natalie Owasa rode her bike to the council meeting. She hangs her clothes outside to dry and used cloth diapers with her children. But she testified against Bill 40.
I totally am for the environment, but I am really concerned about this bill because good policy is simple and easy to understand, and I don't think this bill is. I'm also a CPA. I've worked with small businesses for about 25 years. I know there are some small businesses that will struggle with this. Granted, there are some that cater to environmental conscious customers. They will probably have a good time, but other businesses are going to struggle. And my other concern with this is that we are going to see some unintended consequences from this. You know, it's nice to think that we will clean our straws and that we will clean our bags, but I don't know very many people who do that.
Jimmy Chan is the owner of Hawaiian Chip Company in Kalihi, which manufactures sweet potato and taro chips, sauces, and dips. He's also the president of the trade group, Hawaii Food Manufacturers Association. Chan opposed the bill, and he spoke with our producer, Jason Ubai, this morning.
My reaction is just being disappointed. I really was hoping that we wouldn't be, raising costs for businesses and consumers, you know, unnecessarily. And it's definitely disappointing, but I think at this point, just kind of look forward to working with City Council on the administrative rules and just making sure everything's defined clearly so that we, as much as possible, avoid the unintended consequences that the industry kind of fears may pop up. You know, I think in terms of having availability of enough alternative supply, you know, that's been put into question. And then even just minimizing impact for local businesses on both the restaurant side, the food industry side, and then even local suppliers, just making sure that they're still able to supply if those exemptions are granted for businesses to use various materials. So, you know, we just want to make sure that the supply chain is not disrupted.
Business in particular, how do you think this will affect effects do you see coming from this bill?
Yeah, so, you know, our manufacturing side is probably going to be okay. However, we do have a retail business. The cost of our bags to put products in, you know, our chips made to order, that's going to definitely change even some of our processes. You know, so we sell dip that fits under the prepackaged food label because we have them sitting in a cooler or in a refrigerator. And then when customers come, they grab the dips and it qualifies and it's exempt under the prepackaged food category. But then if we're out of dip and a customer orders it, there seems to be some confusion on whether or not we can go ahead and make that for them to take with them. Does that become a prepared food at that point? So, you know, it's just getting through those kind of definitions that will impact us. And, you know, because, again, I think that that's a container that would probably have to fall under an exemption because I'm still looking for alternative containers to hold the dip. But, again, it sounds like they want to work through those details. And, you know, we'll just do the best we can to voice concerns. And we appreciate all the efforts that have been made to make sure that the prepackaged foods are safe at this point.
One last question. I know a lot of the testifiers yesterday were in support, and a lot of them were saying, you know, some businesses just need to move on or, you know, just looking more towards the future. What do you have to say to them? What's your response to those kind of criticisms?
You know, I appreciate the passion that they bring to this argument, but one of the things they got to take into account is consideration is that not all businesses are the same. I mean, we exist because we're different. We have unique products. Those products have different packaging demands. We also service different demographics of clients and customers. So some can afford to pass on cost an extra dollar per meal unit or whatever it is, and some are going to be really tough because they service a much more cost-conscious consumer. You know, I think those are things that should be taken into account, and including the materials needed to harbor some of this food safely and effectively. It varies from food to food, like cold items versus very hot, soupy items. It's going to have different needs.
Jimmy Chan, owner of the Hawaiian Chip Company and president of the Hawaii Food Manufacturers Association, he was speaking about the effects that Bill 40 might pose on small businesses.
Without a Doubt, Says You is the toughest quiz show on the air and one of the funniest forms of recreational thinking. How did the princess release the frog prince from his spell?
As I recall, the original version of it ended with the words, "Tastes like chicken."
Spirited and civil, brainy and boisterous, Says You.
Tonight at 6:30, following Marketplace.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Unihoa, Today, we look at the origins of KTA superstores. Only found on Hawaii Island, the supermarket chain had modest beginnings. Koichi and Tanio Taniguchi opened a 500-square-foot grocery and dry goods store in 1916 to provide friends and family with the supplies they needed. In the early days, Koichi took orders from Hilo families and delivered groceries to them. By 1940, they made enough money and opened a second store in downtown Hilo. In 1959, they opened a location on the leeward side of the island in Kailua Kona, and they now have locations in Hilo, Keoho, Waimea, and Waikoloa Village. In 2018, the company opened a KTA Express in Kealakekua, which is a smaller footprint than a superstore, but has many of the same departments and carries its Mountain Apple brand. While it is the largest grocery chain on the Big Island with 7 stores, it no longer has its original location. Where was its first location? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you think you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from the real estate agents and staff of Locations, proudly supporting HBR's commitment to sharing local stories of Hawaii's people and places. Locations, welcome home.
This week was the first ever summit to look at the greenhouse gas emissions as it's linked to air travel. HBR's Noe Tanigawa joins us this morning to talk about what this means in a state that's dependent on tourism.
I know, exactly. I like the blue send-off into this topic, you know what I mean? Because it's kind of the big elephant in the room. We've got 10 million people coming here, you know, every year, and all of them travel at least 4,000 miles, you know, if they go back home. And so what are we going to do about this? A few things are coming together that are paving the way for this conference that happened this week, all about renewable aviation fuels. What's happening internationally is that there's an international aviation organization that governs, you know, all the airlines that fly. And what they did was come up with an accord that's like the Paris Accord for the flight sector. I mean, I wasn't aware that the Paris Climate Accord applies to electricity and ground transportation. There's another one for maritime activities, and there's this one that governs the flight sector. So 2019, all the airlines were supposed to start tracking and reporting their greenhouse gas emissions, and that was to create a baseline. That will be the cap for future emissions. Next year, 2020, is when voluntary compliance is going to start. And this conference that happened on Tuesday involved 4 airlines major to Hawaii that have signed on to this voluntary agreement. That's Hawaiian, United, Alaska, and Southwest. They're all on board to, you know, get with it for 2020. 2027 is when all major airlines are going to have to get on board. So we're looking at this timeline. Joelle Simon-Petri is a former senior military analyst. She's the former operational manager of GiftPAC, which was the Green Initiative for Fuels Transition Pacific at PATCOM. And that's how she got involved with, you know, renewable fuels. She owns a sustainability consulting company now. And she convened this aviation and climate change summit because she said the time is ripe for Hawaii to maybe make some money on helping airlines meet their renewable energy mandate.
Very large corporate customers for airlines have actually been demanding better environmental performance. Financial services firms, consulting firms, they actually have corporate sustainability goals that are actually part of a requirement on their chief financial officers for performance. And the airline that they choose for their corporate contracts each year is actually also based on a sustainability criteria now. This is a relatively new issue for the aviation industry. But it's similar to what the insurance industry went through 10 years ago when the insurance industry started to price in climate change and sea level rise risk to its customers. And that's where we really started to see some actual thrust in the business community to care about and start to address climate change.
This is serious stuff.
Kind of makes sense, right? I mean, that's where climate change enters the business market, that question of risk. Ultimately, what we have to do is assign dollar values to environmental costs and benefits. I mean, carbon pricing, that's what we've got to do. But that is the way that renewable fuels will be able to compete with fossil fuels and the established pipeline that these fossil fuels have, right? Renewable fuels could even turn out to be cheaper because they'll be more valuable in terms of their overall value, factoring in the carbon offset and so on. And some of these renewable jet fuels are more efficient because they have a lower freezing temperature. You know, so, I mean, there are all kinds of factors that people have been working on. And Michael Wolcock, who's the Regents Professor at Washington State University, studies alternative jet fuels. He's the director of ASCENT, which is the FAA's Center of Excellence for Alternative Fuels. And he says renewable fuels have just got to be cost effective.
Yeah, so the approach that we like to use and is going forward in a lot of activities is to use carbon that's already in the economy. And what I mean by that is we have all kinds of products that we've used once already and is now a waste product and is a liability to society in some way, shape, or form. So forest residuals are one of those. But there are other ones, like municipal solid waste is an area that's going forward now. Probably the next alternative jet fuel plant in the United States will be operating on municipal solid waste.
Municipal solid waste. You know, on Oahu. Yeah, our ears perk up. That's H-Power, man. We don't even have enough garbage for H-Power, right? How could we possibly use some of it for jet fuel? Well, it turns out that a lot of material cannot be accepted by H-Power and does end up in landfills here. You know, Simon Pietri's research has convinced her that Oahu could produce 10 million gallons of jet fuel a year by converting construction and demolition debris, which cannot go into H-Power currently. That is the minimum scale necessary for a viable commercial facility. Now, Simon Pietri says Oahu produces 500 to 700 tons of construction and demolition debris a day. Much of it's treated lumber, and it just can't be burned by H-Power. And processes to be able to use treated lumber for this, you know, renewable purpose are under development. Simon Pietri says technical problems of producing energy through this kind of process are largely solved already. And in fact, our project here is part of a national collaboration to produce renewable fuels. They've already proven that they can fly a plane on basically what used to be trees. Alaska Airlines flew a passenger jet on that several years ago. Really exciting stuff. And so all the trials and testing are underway.
The large international airlines have been out in front actively looking for renewable fuel supply, for sustainable aviation fuel supply. And right now, the window is open and the opportunity is good for Hawaii to be a leader in that space and be one of the first ones, certainly the first one from an island location, to be able to offer sustainable aviation fuel.
Wow, that's yeah, something.
To be a leader, that would be amazing.
It would, and it'd be something that would, you know, be produced here out of a waste product. And the sort of technology and the intellectual property for how to prepare these this treated lumber for use in this way would, of course, be an intellectual property asset from here.
Now, I know that we've seen the solar-powered plane go from, you know, all over the globe, basically.
Right.
That was a real, you know,
amazing
thing to see. And then I think one of the smaller airlines, I think Island Air, is experimenting with batteries. So, yeah, you want to be able to get on the plane and not feel so guilty that
right,
you're polluting our Earth.
And the fact that people might be able to fly here and then pick up a renewable fuel, fill up the tanks that way and go somewhere else is kind of amazing, because people are starting to really think about that sort of issue of guilt-free travel. You know what I mean? I mean, certainly people in the environmental science sector are limiting their travel already. You know?
Yeah, we saw that young girl coming out on climate change,
Greta Thunberg.
Right. Right? She didn't take a plane.
And then now she's got to go to Spain. I mean, you know, this could cause some problems. And certainly for us, Simon Pietri's point is that developing a renewable aviation fuel could actually make us a lot safer. you know, in terms of, for one, the kinds of ups and downs in the tourism industry that can come when we've got those, you know, oil fluctuations, we could be partially protected from that, and we would have a renewable oil supply here in case of cargo disruptions or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I know just people that we've talked to, Chip Fletcher, mm-hmm. I know he says he tries to watch his footprint and not fly off to so many conferences. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting to see what people will do to help us with our goals and control their footprint.
And the whole question was, can Hawaii also make money on this, develop new technologies that will be useful to other places on Earth? I mean, that's the kind of synergy that's possible in a state like Hawaii that's already set such really ambitious renewable energy goals.
Well, let's hope so, right? Because we're going to be hitting 10 million tourists a year.
And we're supposed to be 100% renewable by 2045.
Okay, we got to hurry up. All right, thanks so much. That was HPR's Noe Tanigawa. To read her story on this climate issue, head to our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. Now time for our reality check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. Today, Chad Blair joins us to talk about the Aloha Medical Mission effort to immunize families in Samoa because of a deadly measles outbreak there. Good morning, Chad.
Good morning, Catherine.
So one of your reporters is down there as we speak, Anita.
Yeah, that's right. That's Anita Hofschneider. We also sent a photographer, videographer, Ku'u Kalanoe. She's on our staff as well. And the two of them, I believe, may be finally on their way back. They've been down there a couple of days. Of course, as we all know, there's been something like more than 70 healthcare officials from Hawaii, but also dozens more from New Zealand and Australia responding to this awful situation. I was just checking Anita's Twitter feed. The count now is 68, at least the last check, people that have died in Samoa from measles. Most of those are babies. Most of those are children. There is also a lot of people that are very sick because the lack of immunization, the vaccination problem. So it's really been quite a story. And on our website, not only does Anita have her story and our photos, but it just kind of grabs your, just touches you tremendously that Hawaii reaches out to try and help these folks, but makes it also very sobering how dire the situation is there.
Yes, it's heartbreaking because I know they were saying that we were, you know, close to, I think, eliminating measles at one time.
Yeah.
And it's just like, and to have this happen on a tiny community like that where the death toll is so high.
Right. And the goal for the vaccines that the doctors and nurses are bringing is 50,000. That is what their plan is. You know, Anita provides some context as to why there has been a problem with vaccinations. A couple of years ago, there were two children that she reported died from a badly mixed vaccine. And because of that, there has been suspicions among a lot of people in the local populace there. And the number of vaccine rate actually plunged from 70% to 30%. On the plus side, as of today, most kids are now vaccinated, and that gives one hope. But there still is some concern among folks in Samoa as to, you know, how safe are vaccines. As you know, there are people in this country that have their own questions about vaccines.
Right. And I think to hear of a death due to measles, I think was, you know, not so common, but to have this number, it's pretty startling.
It is. And the scene that Anita describes is essentially the country is at a standstill, that there still is a state of emergency. Walking around the area, a lot of places are closed. She uses the word eerie to describe the feeling. The public has essentially been ordered to stay home until the clear is given. There's also the challenge about the heat there in Samoa, closer to the equator than we are, I believe. And you have to keep these vaccinations cool in these carriers and not have them spoiled. So there's that challenge in terms of logistics. She describes being on the ground there initially as a bit of an organized chaos scene, but there has been a lot of progress. And, of course, this was organized by our lieutenant governor, Josh Green, literally a last-minute trip to go with these nurses and doctors, as well as media, to Samoa.
Right, and Hawaiian Airlines chartered down there.
Exactly, and then Queens, Hawaii Pacific Health, I know Kaiser has been involved. And this wasn't apparently just something that Josh Green said, hey, let's go to Samoa. Of course, we all know he's a medical doctor, and he's been very active, certainly with the homeless population here in the islands. He was actually contacted by somebody in the World Health Organization to help organize this. So there was an invitation, if you will, on the part of Hawaii, and as I said, New Zealand and Australia, to see what they could do down there.
Yes, and to have that kind of response from the local businesses and our medical community, it's tremendous.
Yeah, you know, in here in Hawaii, as you said, measles, we all kind of think, that's something you get taken care of when you're kids. You know, it's not going to be a problem. But I think the Department of Health just this week reminded folks that travelers coming along from a plane, Hawaii is this center in the Pacific, that there have been cases of measles here, and that we have to be very vigilant. The main thing to do, the advice from the Department of Health, is get vaccinated. Get that, what's it called, an MMR, I think, mm-hmm. is the preferred vaccination. I know I had one before I went overseas last year to a few countries in Asia as a precaution.
You know, as I've been reading these stories in the newspapers and online, some of the pictures of the little kids crying, I was just like, you know, I've had shots where, you know, it didn't faze me. And so, you know, you don't want to scare them off.
No, and it really kind of there's our lead photo actually on our homepage, and I got to give credit to the Star Advertiser. They have a pretty compelling photo up there on their front page, their website. It really just makes you go, oh my gosh, how terrible! But I think that's part of the deal. When we grow up, certainly in our country, we're kind of used. Most of us are used to going to the doctor regularly,
right,
and getting our checkups, getting our vaccinations. That's not necessarily the case in other parts of the world.
Right. But shots don't have to hurt. Thanks a lot, Chad.
Sorry about that.
Okay. That was Chad Blair with today's Reality Check. To read Anita Hofschneider's story, visit civilbeat.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Haleakala Waldorf School, announcing its 34th annual holiday fair this Saturday from 9 to 4, featuring live entertainment and children's activities. WaldorfMoe.org.
Coming Saturday, December 7th. He's a little bit reggae, a little bit folk, and a whole lot of positive island vibes. It's singer-songwriter Paul Isaac. The Oahu native brings a message about unity and making our world a better place, and it's his first time in HPR's Atherton Studio. Get your tickets now at hprtickets.org. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
My name is Chris Friend-Rice. I'm the Director of Operations for Veterinary Emergency and Referral Center of Hawaii. Our favorite thing about being an underwriter for HPR is definitely the feeling that we are giving back to the community. In general, that's something that our business tries to do on a regular basis. Hawaii Public Radio, being something that we all listen to personally, was a natural choice for us to support that and give back.
Hawaii Public Radio Underwriting. Your message heard here.
You are back with the conversation. No one disputes that we need more housing here in the state, but the question is, how do we get the units built? HPR's Ryan Finnerty joins us now with more on that. Good morning.
Hey, Catherine. Yeah, and so for a little bit of background, everybody knows it's expensive in Hawaii, but a big part of that is housing, and a big part of the reason housing is expensive is there is more demand than there is supply. And the State Department of Business, Economic Development, and Tourism projects that statewide we'll need 65,000 new homes by 2025 to correct this shortage. And about 40% of those are on Oahu, so the lion's share. But Maui and Hawaii Island both also need quite a bit, between 10 and 20,000 new units on each of those islands. And so the big question is, how do we do that? How do we get there? And State Senator Stanley Chang, who's from Oahu, the Kahala area, convened a summit recently to bring together different people from the development industry, construction, finance, public utilities, and government to explore some of these issues surrounding how we can address that housing shortage and how what it would actually take to build that much housing. One of the major issues that was discussed was infrastructure. If you're going to build 65,000 new housing units, that means that you need a lot of new connections to sewer, water, and electricity. And the experts present started with the idea that it's more efficient to increase density in areas that are already serviced by those utilities than it is to extend utilities out into undeveloped areas.
These kind of large programs, large wastewater projects, they do take time. What we need to know is, where is the development happening?
Are you placing those developments in areas where we have the system capacity? Because you're not adding tens of miles of pipeline that has to be repaired and replaced over time.
And that was Tim Houghton from the City and County of Honolulu and Barry Usagawa from the Honolulu Board of Water Supply. So they're players in Oahu's sewer and drinking water network. And so what this means is that communities like urban Honolulu, Hilo, and Wailuku are going to be where the new housing gets built most likely, rather than out in undeveloped land. And because the summit was on Oahu, many of the experts were pulled from the Honolulu area, and they focused on the specific issues facing Honolulu and building more housing. But a lot of the themes are kind of universal and just need to be tweaked with each specific community's particular concerns.
Right. And the idea is that the density, they want to go where the rail route is. You know, there's a lot of talk about that.
Yeah, that's the plan on Oahu. And so you heard those guys talking about, we need to know where the development's going to be. Here on Oahu, we kind of know that the plan is to build along the rail corridor. On neighbor islands, that's, you know, maybe not so definite. So those are the kind of conversations that need to get had. And here on Oahu, one of the major issues has been sewer capacity. That's been a big impediment to development. There was actually a developer in the audience, not part of one of the panels, who during the question portion got up and said that his firm has had building permits for housing projects denied because there wasn't sewer capacity in the area where they wanted to build. And as we heard Tim Houghton say, officials kind of need to know where they're going to put in that extra capacity because it takes so long. Some of these projects are years. I was looking at a few that are under development right now, and there really wasn't one that was less than 2 or 3 years from planning to construction and completion. Some of them are 5 years or 10 years. And he said that the board of, or that the city and county has 15-year plans out for where they're going to build. So it takes a long time. And that's really the most outstanding issue when it comes to building more housing. But there's also the issue of water. You can't have sewer without water. Everybody needs drinking water to cook and for sanitation. And Barry Usagawa, who we heard from earlier from the Board of Water Supply, was one of the officials who spoke. And he echoed the importance in that clip of building around developed infrastructure that the board already has in place. And the good news when it comes to water, at least on Oahu, is that there's plenty of water available. The Board of Water Supply maintains sustainable pumping limits for the island's 24 aquifers. And what that means is they aren't at risk of being depleted. So they make sure that we're not pumping above the recharge rate. But he did say that the aquifer that supplies urban Honolulu is near that sustainable limit. So we can't pump much more water out of that particular aquifer. So what they do is they have a series of pipelines that move water around the island. So from the rainy windward side, those aquifers might get recharged more quickly. They have a smaller population. Water can actually be piped to other parts of the island where it's needed. West Oahu, where there's been a lot of development in the last 20 years, is drier. So those aquifers can be at risk of depletion. So there's some pipelines that bring water from different parts of the island to there and into town. There's 2,000 miles of pipeline already in place, which I thought was a pretty staggering number. And so the point was kind of that we need to build around that existing infrastructure, and doing so will reduce both the cost of new construction, but also the time it takes to get it up, because this is a pretty pressing issue. 65,000 new units by 2025, the state Department of Business, Economic Development, and Tourism says. One of the other major issues that was raised is, so you've got the land, you've got the utilities ready, now you actually have to build something. How do you build it in a way that allows you to sell units cheaply, in a way that's actually at a price that's actually affordable to regular people? There's a lot of planning that has to go into that. We know it's going to need to be high density style apartment buildings, because we're building in an already developed area. Those are more efficient than single family homes. But those types of buildings are really expensive to make. There's a lot of drilling that has to go on, a lot of concrete, a lot of construction, a lot of labor costs. They're time consuming. So those costs can really add up. And cause those units to be a lot more expensive. So one of the guys who spoke at this summit was Michael Vacchio. He's with the local venture capital firm JL Capital. And he says that developing this kind of housing cheaply in mass quantities will require a whole new approach to design and building.
To build these buildings for this cost, you have to change the rules. You have to change your typical approach to buildings. Typical approach is you design, you bid, you value engineer, and you build. You lose time, you lose everything. It just becomes a harder process. So the idea is, if you flipped the whole design process on its head, what would happen? Don't design from the outside in. Design from the inside out. Efficiency, cores, that's what you have to look at. It's all about efficiency.
And so he gave a couple examples of that. His first one was, you need to build tall buildings. Taller buildings allow for more units, which allow you to distribute those construction costs over more buyers, basically. And he said that when it comes to building a tall building like this, most of the cost is actually in the foundation, in the base. That's where you spend the most time and money, so that when you're building up, it allows you to distribute those foundation costs. Another thing he mentioned, minimizing amenities like pools. Those are really expensive to put in and then maintain once people are actually living there. And elaborate exterior facades. You know, a lot of the buildings that have gone up in Ala Moana and Honolulu have these really visually appealing designs, but that makes them very time consuming and expensive to bring in that special glass and for laborers to put in. So all things like that you can kind of simplify, make your floor plan in such a way that the building can go up quickly and easily, and that allows you to put housing up at a cheaper price.
Do they talk a lot about tax credits?
That was a point of discussion. There weren't a ton of public officials, elected officials talking about that. Some of the developers, you know, mentioned that these things are out there. There was one gentleman from a local contracting firm who said that it's really not realistic to think the building industry is going to be able to do this without help. And his sort of implication was, we're going to need some kind of help from different stakeholders, including government, in the form of tax credits or changes to building standards, all of which we've seen in the last year.
Right. In Kaka'ako in particular, I think they had developer Stanford Carr has worked with the Housing Corporation, you know, with those tax credits to get some of these mix of units up, so it's not just all luxury.
Yeah, and we saw the Honolulu City Council this past year passed a law signed by the mayor that eased some of the building restrictions for these type of low-cost, affordable units. So there's some things out there in the works to try and make this idea a reality. But, you know, as we said in the beginning, it's going to be a heavy lift, 65,000 units statewide in the next 6 years.
Yeah, we can't get it built fast enough. Ryan, thank you.
Sure thing.
We've been talking to Ryan Finnerty about the housing challenges ahead for the state. To read his stories, go to HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Scheidler Family Foundation, supporting the Scheidler College of Business at UH Manoa. The next Kona Info Session for the Distance EMBA and Master of HR is tomorrow. Scheidler.hawaii.edu.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we look at a century-old family business on Hawaii Island, known for its private label, Mountain Apple Brand, and the Living in Paradise show. KTA Superstores is an iconic grocery store chain found only on the Big Island. Through the years, it's opened stores all over the island, including a KTA Express store in Kealakekua. When the Express location opened in 2018, it was the first grocery store in the area since 2009. The family business has spanned four generations of leadership. Koichi and Tanio Taniguchi started the business and added the letter A to their initials to avoid confusion with a competitor. The business was then led by their son, Tony Taniguchi, and he was succeeded by his nephew, Barry Taniguchi, who passed away in September. Barry's son, Toby, is currently the president and COO. The chain now has three stores on the Kona side and four on the Hilo side, but it all started with a modest 500-square-foot grocery and dry goods store in Waiakea. That was the answer we were looking for. Unfortunately, the store no longer stands today because it was destroyed in the 1946 tsunami. And Jennifer of Kailua Kona got the answer right, so congrats to you. And that's today's quiz. If you have an idea for one, please send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. New York comedian Hari Kondabolu. Did I get that right?
Yes.
Kondabolu. He's in the islands. He played Maui last night. He'll be at Waikiki's Blue Note tonight. And he joins us this morning to talk story about his brand of comedy.
Thank you for having me. No, it's good to be here.
So you're actually going to go to the Ninth Island. You go to Vegas after this.
Is that the Ninth Island?
Yes.
I'm in Vegas next week. I have a feeling that I'm going to enjoy the... I don't think Vegas is going to top what I've experienced here, to be perfectly honest. It's not nearly as beautiful.
I saw your tweet. You said, the scam is on. You're in Maui.
That's what, I mean, honestly, when I told other comedians I was performing in Maui and in Oahu, like the reactions, I mean, people I don't even know that closely were cursing me out. Just like, oh, wow, this stand-up comedy scam has worked. I've made this work in my favor. Yeah.
Well, it's funny because, you know, we here in the islands, you know, when we go to New York, we're like, oh, we got to go to the Blue Note and catch some acts. And then you're coming here to our Blue Note.
Yeah, I've never performed in the Blue Note in New York, but I get to play the one in Hawaii, and I'm just as happy, if not happier, about that.
Oh, yeah. So. Well, it's great. Well, we're glad you're here.
Thank you.
Now, you actually got started in comedy because you had a kind of a serious day job.
Yeah, I mean, I started in comedy when I was like 17, 18. I was in high school, and it's something I always loved to do. I started doing comedy before I became a socially aware or politically active person. And, you know, after college, I was working at an immigrant rights organization. This is like 2005, a few years after 9/11, after the backlash. So I was working with victims of hate crimes and working with refugees and people who were being detained and deported. So it was heavy stuff. My boss at the time actually was Pramila Jayapal, who's now a congressperson out of Seattle. But, you know, I did comedy at night. It was a young scene in Seattle, a healthy scene, and I did it for fun, and it was something I didn't expect to be a career, because how many South Asians were in the media at the time? How many South Asians were in films and TV? How many South Asians were doing stand-up? So, you know, I didn't see myself as someone breaking any barriers, and so I did it for fun, and I had this job that I absolutely loved, and next thing I knew, I get discovered, I get to be on TV, I have a manager, and, you know, that was about 12 years ago now, and all of a sudden, more than probably 13 years ago now, and you know, I've been doing it ever since, full time.
Okay, so what did your parents say?
Well, you know what? Here's the thing about that. Like, if I had started straight out of college doing stand-up, I think they would have freaked out, but I played it smart where I went to grad school and got a master's from London School of Economics. It had a job before, and was on TV twice before I said to them, I think I'm going to pursue stand-up. So as long as you're able to get a graduate degree,
yes,
and
show your parents
and be on TV multiple times to prove to them that this is a viable profession, then it's a little easier to be like, okay, he's not going to be a doctor.
Yeah. And so this isn't your first trip to Hawaii.
No, this is my second. That's why I wanted to come back. And I did an artist in residency with the Shangri-La Museum, you know, the Doris Duke Museum. And I did a show with my brother last time I was here, our Kundabola Brothers podcast, as well as a stand-up show. And I just loved it so much. I was just obviously in awe of the place, just shocked by the history. Also, the context is so different. Like, to... You know, throughout the mainland, it's like I'm a visible minority, and it's a white majority country and the white majority area. And then to come to Hawaii and then all of a sudden not feel like I'm in the minority in the same way is a remarkable feeling. You know, to actually not feel like an outsider in my own country, like I was just in awe of that feeling. And so, you know, in addition to the fascinating history here, as someone who talks about history a lot in my act and colonialism, I mean, this place is ripe with discussions of that. And so I'm just like, you know, to me, this was such a wonderful place. I was actually surprised people even came to my show last time. Just I'm like, it's so beautiful here. Why would you want to see somebody talk? Like, if I had the choice between going to the beach and seeing somebody talk, I'd go to the beach, right? Not to say you shouldn't come see me at the Blue Note tonight at 6:30 at 9. I'm just saying that, you know, if for me, I can't imagine wanting to be indoors, but I also know if you live here, it's probably a little different.
Yeah, you know, and because the mainland is a long ways away, it's really cool when we've got good acts in town, you know, to support that, so we get keep the pipeline going.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think any artist, this is a dream gig, and it's one that, you know, I feel like I've been here a few days. I did a show in Maui. I'm relaxed. Now the only thing is justify the trip by having a good show.
Like, make people laugh.
Make sure you do your job. And I feel pretty confident just because, like, audiences here are extremely attentive and thoughtful and smart. And the experience I've had from my Maui show and from last time I was here, like, I feel pretty good about it.
Well, I know in one of your bits you talk about how you look like a Muppet working on a PhD, and I was thinking, you've grown a beard since. So you look more like from Cheech and Chong. Right,
a little more like Tommy. Well, I mean, to be fair, the rest of that joke was also about how handsome I am despite that. So that just for full context. Yeah, I mean, like, my style is very professorial. Like, I know that. And for some people, it's like, what's going on? But I do feel like there's punchlines in it. There's tons of jokes in it. So it's just a matter of, like, if you can set through me, you know, be there for me setting it up, you'll get the reward at the end. So I like a patient, thoughtful audience.
And so how are you treated as you go from place to place? I mean, people aren't sure what nationality you are, or how does that work?
You know, it's gotten better. I mean, certainly when I started in, like, 2005, 2006, I think there was a curiosity of seeing me on stage telling jokes without an accent. Do you know what I mean? We're talking, it's not even that long ago to me,
right.
But
you look like a terrorist, but
right, like post 9/11, right? And I didn't even have a beard back then. So, like, the stereotypes, also, like, confronting them when you're on stage is hard, or even having to address what are you within the first minute of being on stage, because that's the elephant in the room for people, is like, why does he look like that? Why is he talking like that? My brother says that during those days, it was almost, for a lot of people, it must have been like seeing a dog talk. Like, you couldn't even imagine the possibility, you know, aside from, oh, also they're going to entertain us. Like, just the idea this person is talking and sharing their experience, first generation who is, you know, born here and actually, you know, being able to share their experiences the way I did, and you know, Aziz and Mindy Kaling and Hasan Minhaj and that first wave did. So, you know, I feel like, yeah, like, now it's a little less like that. I feel like it's less of a shock to see me on stage. And I think the issues I'm dealing with more now is, you know, as much as I'm touring the country all over the place and being able to perform in the American, you know, in the South and on the coasts and in the middle of the country and taking risks, I'm still, you know, dealing now post-Trump with some people not handling it as well. Like, I was in Ann Arbor, Michigan, which is a very liberal place. Middle of one of my shows, a guy stood up and yelled, "Hail Trump." Mm. And just the idea that the word Trump is used as a threat, you know, it's very pregnant, has a great deal of meaning in it. And so, you know, that's the new struggle now, the idea of people trying to silence voices of color and people whose points of view historically have been marginalized.
I remember as a kid, my first trip to the mainland, I was 11, and I was riding my cousin's bicycle, and someone yelled out in the truck, "Get off the road, you dirty little Mexican." And I was like, "I'm not Mexican." And then come to find out, you know, you do your DNA, I'm Native American. So it's like, I guess he was right, but I don't think I was dirty that day.
And I don't think he thought about it that much. It's never like, you know, when people say, go back to your country, they're not, that sometimes I think you're only saying that because you don't know what country my heritage is from. But yeah, I mean, that's why, you know, I feel like being on stage and sharing your truth is so important, because that might be the only perspective people have. And so I take the responsibility seriously to share my truth and to be honest up there. And because, like, I remember a time where there were no voices. We just had Apu from The Simpsons. And so for me, this is all icing on the cake.
Yeah, and so we certainly have had lots of heavy news with the impeachment, you know, everywhere on the airwaves and in the newspaper. But if folks want catharsis, they can come and spend some time with you tonight.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks so much. It's been a pleasure having you.
Thank you so much.
We have been having a good time here talking to Hari Kondobolu. You can see him in the flesh tonight at the Blue Note in Waikiki. He has two shows, 6:30 and 9. That is it for today. Up tomorrow, our show goes to the animals. Do you have a story about the Honolulu Zoo to share? Call or talk back line. Leave your comments. The number to do that? 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We are on Facebook at The Conversation HPR and Twitter at HI Conversation. And if you missed any of this show or want to find a past one, look under HPR News and Talk for The Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.